Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. An historic week for the nation with sober implications. For only the fourth time, the U.S. House introduced articles of impeachment against the sitting president of the United States. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler set out the case that President Trump's actions constituted an abuse of power. Nadler pointed to the president's rejection of congressional oversight and his refusal to be held responsible for his actions.
What is central here is, do we want a dictator? No matter how popular he may be, no matter how good or bad the results of his policies may be, no president is supposed to be a dictator in the United States.
House Republicans, outnumbered, stood by their president, depicting impeachment as just another step in a process they deride as driven by people unhappy with the results of the 2016 election. Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida.
Impeachment is their passion, their drug, their all-consuming ambition and obsession.
And across the pond, what some are calling the most consequential election in a generation. The British people gave Prime Minister Boris Johnson a resounding victory after 3.5 years of debate over breaking with the European Union.
This one nation conservative government has been given a powerful new mandate. To get Brexit done. And not just to get Brexit done, but to unite this country and to take it forward.
With us from Washington is Liz Landers. She's a D.C. correspondent for Vice News. Elizabeth, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Annie Carney. She's a White House reporter for the New York Times. Annie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Elizabeth, and Annie.
So let's start at the top of the week. We had the House Judiciary Committee hearings on these articles of impeachment that were unveiled. Liz Landers, take us through what the House Judiciary shared with the nation, what they presented and what you think they accomplished this week.
Sure. So this week we saw the impeachment inquiry move into the Judiciary Committee. It had been in the Intelligence Committee before. That's where we had seen Chairman Adam Schiff laying out sort of the case for impeachment by interviewing fact witnesses. That was all the testimony we saw a few weeks ago. This week was focused more on allowing the Democrats and the Republicans in the Judiciary Committee to debate, essentially, for an entire week whether the president should be impeached. So we saw earlier in the week a number of lawyers basically presenting the case on behalf of the Democrats and then on behalf of the Republicans. And sometimes they were questioning one another about the facts of the impeachment inquiry. And then later on in this week, in the past few days, we've seen the members debating one another. So that was the very long, extremely long hearing that we saw last night. It lasted about 14 hours, where members of the Judiciary Committee sat and debated one another. And as someone who covers Congress, that's not something you always see. Members don't really get time to parse each other's arguments. So it might be tedious to sit and watch that, but it is kind of refreshing to see the Democrats and Republicans go back and forth on these issues.
Annie Carney, I want to play for you a little clip. At a press conference Tuesday, House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff, who obviously oversaw the investigative part of what we saw in recent weeks, he made the case publicly that impeachment was not simply about past abuses of power, but that failing to impeach President Trump would allow the president to, quote, cheat in another election.
The evidence of the president's misconduct is overwhelming and uncontested. And how could it not be when the president's own words on July 25th, "I would like you to do us a favor, though," lays so bare his intentions, his willingness to sacrifice the national security for his own personal interests. And when the president got caught, he committed his second impeachable act, obstruction of Congress, of the very ability to make sure that no one is above the law, not even the president of the United States.
Annie Carney, what kind of traction, what kind of weight does that argument carry?
I think he's trying to make the point that Democrats are making, that this isn't about opposing Donald Trump's policies or disagreeing with him. This is about that's a separate track that will be decided in the 2020 election. This is simply about the Constitution and about abuse of power, and that they don't really have a choice given his actions. They're trying to make the argument that politics aside, they have no choice. What we're seeing on the floor here is that, you know, every controversy, even marginally related to impeachment, was thrown out yesterday. We're seeing a completely partisan battle over these articles, with Republicans and Democrats just talking completely past each other. And I think what we saw a lot yesterday was what can be considered possibly a preview of the general election, where Matt Gaetz, a Republican, brings up Hunter Biden and his drug issues. These are the kinds of attacks that I think can be seen as a preview of what this completely divided politically country will be going into all of next year.
Yesterday, Jack Beattie, the top Republican for the House Judiciary Committee, as Liz Landers mentioned, Doug Collins was lashed out the chairman after the abrupt delay of the vote of the articles late last night. Collins clearly caught off guard, accused Democrats of waiting for prime viewing hours.
This is why they don't like us, because they know it's all about games. They know it's all about these TV screens. It's all about getting at a president because they want the prime time hit. This is Speaker Pelosi and Adam Schiff and the others directing this committee. I don't have a chairman anymore. I guess I just need to go straight to Ms. Pelosi and say, what TV hit does this committee need to do? Because this committee has lost all relevance.
Jack, after more than 12 hours debate, Democrats said they didn't want it to appear like they were voting in the middle of the night, instead wanted the vote to happen in daylight. Can any of this be viewed as other than in a partisan light? I mean, are there ways to say, you know, there's an affirmative case being made there, both for the process and, I guess, you know, in the background for the substance itself?
Well, the Republicans aren't joining the argument on substance. As that clip indicated, they're fulminating over faux controversies and, histrionic displays. And, you know, what I was struck with was how really the controlling number for this, for the Republicans, was 13,435. Those are the number of, quote, false or misleading claims, according to the Post fact checker, made by the president. And that way of that instinct for dissembling, let's be very soft about it, is full, is what you heard again and again from the Republicans. They simply deal with the facts by saying, well, no, the president really didn't mean this or that. Of course, some said that, but mostly what they said was, no, those aren't the facts at all. What happened isn't what happened. And this continual denial of reality. To me, it had no more indicative moment than the way they dealt with Adam Schiff's paraphrase. This is a month ago, when Adam Schiff was summarizing what the president's phone call was. He said, and to paraphrase what the president said, and he went into this parody of gangster talk. The Republicans kept coming to that and saying, he distorted what the president said. And they never said, he did say it was a paraphrase. That's a deliberate deception of their voters. That's not accidental. That's the president's habit of lying, of dissembling, of deceit that has seeped in right to his party.
And I think it's worth noting, for those of our listeners who are not aware, earlier this morning, the House Judiciary Committee did take its formal vote and approve both articles of impeachment. It's a historic moment, a historic day. By a margin of 23-17, along straight party lines, the Democratic-led House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach President Donald John Trump and to send those along to the full House, where they will be considered presumably next week. President Trump responded to articles of impeachment at a rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania, Tuesday night in anticipation of this moment. It's been common practice for the president to hold rallies in front of friendly supporters when crisis flares in Washington.
Now that the Russia witch hunt is dead, a big, fat, disgusting fraud, the congressional Democrats are pushing the impeachment witch hunt having to do with Ukraine. But that's already failing. You saw their so-called articles of impeachment today? People are saying they're not even a crime. What happened? All of these horrible things, remember? Bribery and this and that. Where are they? They send these two things. They're not even a crime.
The articles of impeachment include abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The second one is similar to one of the charges brought against President Nixon, all those decades ago, contempt of Congress. So that impeachment is like a criminal indictment. And once the House, as seems foreordained, votes to impeach the president of the United States, the actual trial will be held in the U.S. Senate. Unlike the Democratic House, Republicans control the U.S. Senate. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has said he'd align the trial of Trump with the desires of the president's lawyers, right down to what evidence to introduce and whether to call witnesses. He spoke to Fox News last night.
Everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this to the extent that we can. We don't have the kind of ball control on this that a typical issue, for example, comes over for the House. If I don't like it, we don't take it up. We have no choice but to take it up.
So, Annie Carney, we've only got a little bit of time left, about 30 seconds left, but how consequential is it what Mitch McConnell just said?
He went on Hannity last night, i.e. the program where he speaks directly to the president, and he's making it clear that the counsel, he's going to take his cues from the counsel's office, and there's going to be no daylight between what the White House wants and how the Senate Republicans will take this up. I think the Senate Republicans are hoping for a short trial to wrap this up. The president himself has made it clear he thinks that there could be a upside for him to a long trial, a drawn-out thing to present his side of the case. They'll have to come to an agreement on that soon.
It's a pretty striking moment, given the Senate is part of the oversight of the President of the United States. But there we are. We're talking about the articles of impeachment against President Trump that will be voted on in coming days by the full U.S. House of Representatives, plus the report on the investigation into Russian election interference, and Attorney General William Barr's sharp criticism of his own agencies. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Stick around.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. The House of Representatives is poised to impeach President Trump in coming days, making him just the third president in United States history with that mark against his name. We're talking this morning about the substance, the process, the politics, the implications for all of it. We have a superstar and super sharp panel of guests with me this hour. Liz Landers of Vice News, Annie Carney of The New York Times, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. I want to offer a couple of some feedback from listeners thinking about all these things this morning. Jack Vick comments on Facebook, not one word about the Mueller report and nothing about bribery. The Democrats have nothing. If you don't believe me, just ask the Senate. Carl Denham says, it's clear this impeachment attempt is driven mostly by pure politics. Democratic leader Al Green admitted that if this impeachment fails, they're going to attempt it again and again and again. And we've had other comments from our website. Neil Blanchard asked, why is the White House locking up all the records of meetings and phone calls between Trump and Putin? It is perhaps notable that the president's lawyer says
he will argue on behalf of – excuse me, the president's lawyer is expected to argue on behalf of President Trump during the upcoming Senate impeachment trial, according to NBC News, reporting that on the basis of what they were told by a senior administration official. Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, was among those who did not testify in front of the House proceedings. It has been a touchstone for congressional Republicans defending the president to say that Ukraine, like Russia, interfered in the 2016 elections. The form and magnitude very different. Republicans have pointed to an opinion piece by the Ukrainian ambassador, for example. Meanwhile, the U.S. intelligence community says Russia actively sought to disrupt the elections by hacking Democratic emails, activating troll farms, you name it. And here's what U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo underscored on Tuesday in Washington.
On the question of interference in our domestic affairs, I was clear. It's unacceptable. And I made our expectations of Russia clear. The Trump administration will always work to protect the integrity of our elections, period. Should Russia or any foreign actor take steps to undermine our democratic processes, we will take action in response.
I'd like to take a call now from Waterloo, Iowa. Karen, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. First, I want to speak to what was just said. I recently read that the Senate voted down a motion to stop, to prevent Russia from interfering in our election. And I'd like to know, you know, for me, what is their intent if they are going to just allow Russia to interfere and not take any steps, which I don't believe they have done, to stop them from interfering again? They've voted to say, yeah, we'll do it, but the White House has not done. Then what is the intent? Secondly, if they, you've already quoted how many times Mr. Trump has lied and what has happened with regard to his refusal to turn over any documents related to Russia and or his obstruction and the business with Ukraine, I think that any senator, any congressperson who votes to disregard that is also guilty of obstruction. And lastly, I would just like to implore the Republican congresspeople to stop yelling. It is not necessary when you get up to the microphone to yell. It is offensive to me that whenever they have anything to say, it is at the top of their lungs. They do have a microphone, and nothing that they're going to do with regard to volume is going to lend any more credence to the accuracy of their claims or demands.
Well, thank you for that, Karen. Let me throw that to you, Liz Landers. You've been covering all this for Vice News there in the nation's capital. You know, what is the intent of Senate leaders in terms of hearing? And I realize we're leapfrogging a little bit over the formality, but nonetheless, the important historic moment of a full House vote. But if, in thinking about how Republicans on the Senate side are thinking about this, how do they define the charge in front of them?
Well, I think that when you talk to Republicans on the Hill, both on the House and the Senate side, they view the president's power as the executive as broad. And that's the interpretation that these Republicans are or sort of the explanation that they're giving as to why he has not, A, abused power and why he's, B, not obstructing justice. I think when it comes to the abuse of power charge, most Republicans say that the president has executive powers. It's laid out in the Constitution. He is able to make these kinds of requests of foreign governments. That's how it's done. That's how we strike deals when we're dealing with, you know, other countries. And then when it comes to the obstruction of Congress, a lot of these Republicans say, well, these are private conversations happening in the White House and in the executive branch. If you make these sort of things public, then we're never going to get anything done in the government. So, you know, when I am on the Hill talking with these members, that is mostly what I'm hearing. And on the Senate side, too, I think the senators are also really sinking their teeth into the idea that the House and the way that the Democrats in the House conducted this impeachment hearing, you know, gave no due process to the president, which, as you mentioned earlier, he will have more of an opportunity to defend himself via potentially his lawyer in the Senate trial.
And which certainly he took some real actions to discredit along the way, even as He withheld a significant number of the ability of a significant number of people to testify or provide information to the committee, right?
Right. It's an unprecedented, sort of sweeping general no that the White House gave. And we saw that in the letter that the White House counsel sent about a month ago, a long letter sort of in the voice of the president saying, this is a sham and we're not going to turn over any documents. Even in the Nixon trial and in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial, there were tons of documents that were provided. And there were witnesses from the executive branch who were provided to Congress to be questioned. Those kinds of requests, like speaking with the acting chief of staff of the White House, Mick Mulvaney, who has been apparently directly involved in many of these conversations regarding the aid being held from Ukraine. He's been, told not to testify, along with, you mentioned, Secretary Pompeo, a whole host of people who are fact
John
witnesses.
John Bolton, the vice president, kinds of people who might shed light on these very decisions, these very actions.
Right. And those are the fact witnesses that the Republicans keep saying in these hearings for the last week, judiciary has not had fact witnesses. And the Republicans keep saying, we don't have any fact witnesses here. Well, the president has blocked fact witnesses from appearing before the Judiciary Committee.
Chuck Beatty, I want to go to the question. It seems to me there's been a consistent effort to undermine the legitimacy of the process and procedures in the House, but also retroactively an ongoing effort to delegitimize the question of the original investigations of Trump's actions and the Trump world's actions in the 2016 campaign and subsequently. All of this was subject to a number of views, but particularly to the review of Inspector General Michael Horowitz. He's Inspector General for the U.S. Justice Department. He looked into this entire ball of wax, and I want to play two clips from him. He testified before Congress this week, his conclusion that the investigations of the Trump campaign for its ties to the Russians were properly launched.
We did not find documentary or testimonial evidence that indicated political bias or improper motivation influencing his decision to open the investigation.
This was a very sore point for Republicans. And yet, Horowitz did address lawmakers' questions about his report's findings on the FBI's handling of elements of the investigation in the Russian election interference, things like the applications to a FISA court allowing them to do certain kinds of wiretapping abroad and the like. Though the investigation found wrongdoing, the larger investigation into the Trump world found wrongdoing, the Inspector General's report also found deep, deeply inappropriate actions along the way in terms of the ways in which the FBI operated.
We found, and as we outline here, are deeply concerned that so many basic and fundamental errors were made by three separate handpicked investigative teams on one of the most sensitive FBI investigations after the matter had been briefed to the highest levels within the FBI.
So, Jack Beatty, how important is this, and what are we as citizens and as listeners to derive from all this?
Well, it's a mixed verdict, isn't it? Even looking at it objectively, the 17 errors or omissions, to quote from the Horowitz report, made in the FISA applications, that's shocking. And some of it, when you get into the detail of it, it's appalling. I mean, it turns out that Carter Page, the focus of this FISA application, the person they're looking to spy on, essentially, to use that term, had also been working for the CIA. The FBI people knew that and yet didn't pass that on to the FISA court judge. And if this is how they handle a major, the major investigation of our time, really, because it's into a presidential election, what about the average Joe going before hoping to get some, FISA warrant against them? What kind of chance do they have? And I think all of that underscores what Pat Leahy and others have been saying for years, that these FISA applications need to be done under an adversary system. There needs to be a lawyer there speaking for the defendant. And that's not the way it is now. You have to trust the government to turn over all the information. And it's a rubber stamp. These things are just given whenever nearly 100% of applications are granted. And what we see now is they can be deeply tainted, and that can damage citizens' constitutional rights. On the other hand, there is no deep state conspiracy. There is no evidence of political bias in the inception of the report. This throws into the shade, almost 2 years of President Trump's Billingsgate about all this. The deep state, then the FBI is out at, and he was calling the FBI scum the other day in Pennsylvania. You know, they aren't scum. There wasn't political bias. They made terrible mistakes in these FISA applications. But this isn't a witch hunt. And the president and that whole cover story falls. Of course, Fox News didn't represent it that way. Sean Hannity went on and said, everything I've been saying, everything the president has been saying, all vindicated. There's no vindication of that line.
And Annie Carney, before we move on a little bit to what else has happened in Capitol Hill and at the White House this week, it seems to me as though Jack's hit on something interesting, that real abuses, but not the ones that have been identified. Meanwhile, the U.S. Attorney General, Bill Barr, excoriated the FBI this week in interviews with Fox and with NBC's Pete Williams. In this with Williams, Barr blames the FBI's wrongdoing, outlined the Horowitz reports for investigation and impeachment of the president, suggesting they are not legitimate.
I think our nation was turned on its head for 3 years. I think based on a completely bogus narrative that was largely fanned and hyped by an irresponsible press. And I think that there were gross abuses of FISA and inexplicable behavior that is intolerable in the FBI.
So, Annie Carney, what about that? Barr doesn't say, hey, wait a second, maybe we're overbroad in our ability to exercise security authorization to follow our own citizens around, but says, hey, this is deep state stuff. This is a bogus narrative and gross abuses by the FBI. What does that say about the FBI and how is that taken within it?
Well, this is a report that's been hyped by the president and his allies for months, and then it comes out, does not show that what he claimed was true, that there was spying on his campaign or anything else. And Barr and Trump just kind of continued along and kind of turned to the next thing. Like, Barr is conducting his own investigation, and he is reinvestigating the Russia inquiry with John Durham, United States attorney from Hartford, Connecticut, who released a very unusual statement when this report came out, saying he disagreed with the findings and that he was going to conduct a broader, more thorough investigation. So what happened here was the report came out. It didn't prove what the president wanted it to prove. So instead of saying case closed, they've just toggled to the next investigation that Barr is conducting. And Barr, we've seen time and again, has backed up the president in what he wants to hear and what he wants to see. And well, we can expect this investigation to back up theories that have so far no basis in facts.
And Liz Landers, before the end of this segment, I want to move on to the fact that there's been a number of deals struck. It seems as though there's been this update to NAFTA, as sort of a compromise struck between the White House and House Democrats, the USMCA. And they've also struck a budget deal that essentially funded the federal government's operations, I believe, through September 30th, the end of the fiscal year, which may avoid a lot of these so-called continuing resolutions that you have to do to keep government open. Tell me about the ability of the president and, I guess, Speaker Pelosi to reach common ground, even as she's essentially posing an existential threat to his political career.
Right. This has been probably the most interesting contrast that reporters have been following in D.C. this week, this idea that the Democrats are bringing articles of impeachment against the president. But yes, they are striking the USMCA deal, which will replace NAFTA. It's something that Pelosi has been working on with the trade representative Lighthizer for months and months now. And it seems like they were able to reach a deal with Canada and Mexico this week. Pelosi loves to play political games with Donald Trump and with the president. And I think that she knew that it would kind of cause a stir to, you know, release these articles of impeachment on the same day that she said she was going to strike this deal. I would also note that Democrats, her own caucus, has put a lot of pressure on her to strike a deal because there are a number of these Democrats who have flipped districts that were very Republican in 2016. They flipped them to Democrat in 2018. That's why the Democrats have the majority right now. A lot of those endangered Democrats have been pressuring Speaker Pelosi to put USMCA up so that they have something to go back to with their constituents and say, look, we were able to get a budget deal. We were able to get a trade deal even while we're impeaching the president. So she also understands that that helps her own members, too, when they go back home.
Coming up, we're going to be discussing the steps the Trump administration has been taking to stop anti-Semitism on college campuses. We'll be talking about the British elections, about Brexit, about Boris Johnson, and about concerns there as well. And we'll be discussing all the latest from the campaign trail here in the United States. I'm David Folkenflik. Stick around. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're following a bunch of other stories from the week. Here's one that caught the attention of a lot of folks. Houston Police Sergeant Christopher Brewster was killed this week while responding to a domestic violence call. Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, outside the medical examiner's office, slammed Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for not acting to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. According to the Washington Post, he specifically criticized Republican leaders for not supporting an item in the bill that would have stopped domestic partners convicted of domestic violence from possessing firearms.
The NRA doesn't like the fact that we want to take firearms out of the hands of boyfriends that abuse their girlfriends. And who killed our sergeant? A boyfriend abusing his girlfriend. Sure, you're either here for women and children and our daughters and our sisters and our aunts, or you're here for the NRA.
So you have the police chief in a major American city, the fourth largest city in the U.S., one of the largest cities, of course, in Texas, calling out Texas Senators Ted Cruz, John Cornyn for their stances against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, against certain loopholes in gun control laws. And at the same time, those senators say actually existing law should have taken care of that and simply failed to do so. We have an incisive panel of guests this hour with me. Continuing on, we have Liz Landers of Vice News, Annie Carney of the New York Times, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. A little bit later this segment, we'll be talking about the latest from the 2020 candidates on the campaign trail. Yet first, I'd like to turn to focus on a number of events and episodes that raised the question of anti-Semitism. In the United States and around the world, we're seeing a notable rise in anti-Semitic incidents. That's according to groups that monitor such bigotry and by how life is experienced, especially by Jews themselves. This week in Jersey City, New Jersey, hate came with a deadly toll, according to the mayor there. And the Trump administration also is taking a controversial step to stop anti-Semitism on college campuses. We'll talk that in a minute. First, I wanted just to play a clip of Jersey City Mayor Stephen Fulop. He spoke to reporters responding to the deadly shootout at a Jersey City kosher deli. Five people were killed there following the shooting death of Detective Joseph Seals.
There is no question that this is a hate crime, and anti-Semitism should be called out aggressively and firmly immediately for what it is.
Authorities there are starting to look at that as, in fact, a hate crime, that the idea that people were targeted at that market. I also wanted to turn now, Annie Carney, to the Trump administration's steps on college campuses. And it was one that was announced and intended, I believe, to combat what is perceived as anti-Semitism as it affects public stances towards the state of Israel, but also it's one that raised concerns because it involved, in effect, although not in law, considering Jews as though Jewishness itself, Judaism itself, is a nationality. Annie Carney, can you talk to us a little bit about what the administration is trying to address and the way in which it did so?
Sure. Yeah. President Trump signed an executive order earlier this week, which seeks to withhold federal money from education from colleges that failed to combat discrimination against Jews. And so they've been working on this for a long time. They've been actually working on this with some Democrats. One person who was deeply involved with this was a former top advisor to Harry Reid. The thing here, though, is that it wasn't greeted across the board as a great measure to take against fighting anti-Semitism. It's widely acknowledged that anti-Semitism is rising in this country, but critics complain that this policy actually raises questions about stifling free speech, there is legitimate opposition to Israelis' policies towards Palestinians, and squashing that speech on college campuses in the name of fighting anti-Semitism could raise real questions about free speech. So this was greeted – there was a mixed reaction to this executive order from Trump. On the one hand, relief that a president who has failed to condemn white nationalists and anti-Semitism outright in famous incidents like Charlottesville appeared to be taking a stance. On the other hand, raising real questions about free speech on college campuses.
We have Jack, I want to turn
may,
to you. I just want to quote for you, Jack.
I was going to say that a superbly droll comment on this came from Senator Brian Schatz, identified by the New York Times as a, quote, liberal Jewish Democrat. He said, the idea that a college campus would have its views on Israel regulated by the Department of Education, oy gewalt.
Well, I mean, Jack, it's an interesting thing. There's this BDS movement, the idea it's a boycott, divestment of the student activists who are upset about the situation for Palestinians there in Israel and in occupied territories nearby. There's this movement to boycott companies or firms that are based there, do business there, divestment of that, I guess drawing an analogy to this movement to try to divest from companies in South Africa during the apartheid era there, 1980s and early 90s. And there's this intention over whether this is anti-Israel and also whether this is anti-Semitic. Some American Jews have struggle with that very question as well. The identity, the question of being a national identity at the same time in concert with being a religious identity is complicated for a lot of American Jews. And yet you saw people like the head of the American – the AJC, who is himself a liberal figure, essentially endorse this and note that actually under Obama some officials had made movement in that direction as well.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt it's a complicated issue, I think that Senator Schatz has a really good point here, which, this Department of Education adjudicating questions of, well, let's see, is this anti-Semitic? Is that, well, you don't want that has a there's a kind of star chamber quality to that. I would not trust Betsy DeVos to make a sound judgments on this. And it had, you know, this is from a president, you know, Annie has said, who has a very spotted record on this. And just this week, in an address to a Jewish audience, ostensibly speaking in defense of Israel, he spoke many, let out many anti-Semitic tropes. He just, you know, he can't.
Well, I mean, one of the key ones is one of our listeners. As one of our listeners points out, one of the key ones, the idea that Jews care only about money. He essentially said, you know, you guys may hate me, but you're going to vote for me because I'm going to take care of your taxes and I'm going to protect your money, which a lot of Jews took exception to. Liz Landers, I want to go. I realize you guys are based in Washington. At the same time, what happens in London has repercussions here and echoes here. We just saw last night, an extraordinary show of strength by the Conservative Party over there. Boris Johnson, who was essentially a minority government, went back to British voters and say, let's move forward on Brexit, by which he really meant let's move past Brexit. Let's just get this thing done. Stop thinking about it so much. And that seemed to resound. What lessons do you think Americans should take from that? And what do you think we're going to see in terms of the relationship with the U.S. As Britain moves forward in this new thinking, this new new Johnson administration?
Right. Well, it's no secret that President Trump and Boris Johnson like each other. They have an affinity for one another. And President Trump seems to like Johnson a lot more than he liked Theresa May when she was the prime minister. So in terms of the relationship between the two leaders of the countries, I suspect it will continue to be good. You know, a lot of people this morning, you know, you wake up and you see this kind of news and people want to look at what this means for the United States. I think, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, who was running against Boris Johnson with, you know, the Labour Party, basically was running on a platform of socialism. And I think that a lot of Republicans that I've seen this morning here in the U.S. are sort of seizing on this idea that socialism was defeated last night and that Democrats here in the U.S. should take heed. I'm not sure we can make, you know, quite such a direct comparison between British politics and U.S. politics, but it certainly is interesting to see how the British people decided that, you know, Brexit is the top issue over there, and they voted for Boris Johnson again. So that is a ringing endorsement of that policy going forward. So we should expect to see that happen, I think you're right, soon.
Jack Beattie, before we move past the British elections, you and I had talked a little bit before the show, and you'd said in talking about questions of anti-Semitism, this was something which really tore apart in some ways the Labour Party and dominated conversation about them in the weeks leading up to the election.
Such that a substantial, nearly half of British Jews said that they would seriously consider leaving England if Corbyn won. Corbyn, according to the Jewish labor movement, a group of in the labor party, is presiding over an institutionally anti-Semitic party that has and they cite all sorts of examples of this, and it is a. It's a. If there's a consolation in this victory for the Tories, it's that it's a chance for the Labour Department and the Labour Party to come clean, to cleanse itself of this curse, which Corbyn has essentially turned the party, again quoting from the study, into a welcome refuge for anti-Semites. He's going to leave. He's sure. Been defeated, and let's hope that this cause has been defeated too in British politics, this poison.
Annie Carney, one of the things that strikes me about the British election is that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party didn't really have a message. They didn't take a stance on Brexit. It was just like, we're going to fund all these social things that seem to be beside the point. As we look on this side of the Atlantic, as we think about 2020, as we think about the Democrats, you're starting to see some distinctions being made by Democrats, but I'm wondering if any of them you see are able, particularly somebody towards the fore like Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Buttigieg, to make an affirmative case that makes sense in opposition to what the president's saying, which is just, you know, you like me and these guys are trying to take it away from me.
Right. I think they're all trying to do that. It does become harder if the economy continues to roar. It makes it very hard to say to make it a change election. It makes it an easier case for Trump to say, why would you make a big change? The economy is doing great. You have a job. Maybe you don't like my personal style, but you're willing to overlook it when everything in your personal life seems to be going well. But candidates like Warren and Sanders are looking for big institutional change and putting out platforms that ask voters to consider a real message that's a distinct left turn from where Trump is going right now. And we're seeing as these fights between Buttigieg and Warren kind of break out, we're seeing the Democrats really trying to distinguish themselves from one another in a more aggressive way now that we're getting into the end of 19 and into the real election year.
Let me pick that up and play you a clip of the election and a little bit about how those distinctions play out. Pete Buttigieg has faced criticism for his private sector work at the consulting firm McKinsey, in no small part because McKinsey has been involved in advising a lot of its clients to lay people off and to downsize, as they call it. Until this week, Buttigieg hadn't disclosed the clients he worked for because of a non-disclosure agreement. At his urging, McKinsey let him out of that agreement. Buttigieg released the client list. It includes Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Here's part of his interview about all that with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC on Tuesday.
When you did that sort of cost and overhead assessment for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, a couple of years after that, they laid off like 1,000 people. Was your work part of what led to those layoffs?
I doubt it. I don't know what happened in the time after I left. That was in 2007 when they decided to shrink in 2009. Mm-hmm. Now, what I do know is that there are some voices in the Democratic primary right now who are calling for a policy that would eliminate the job of every single American working at every single insurance company in the country.
You know, Annie Carney, it seemed to me that for a while there, Elizabeth Warren had her footing, and she announced this big Medicare for All thing, putting her in the same camp essentially as Bernie Sanders. And yet Pete Buttigieg seemed to have found some traction, or was seeking it by trying to jujitsu and go use all this against her. Where do you see all that standing?
I think the focus on Buttigieg's clients is another reminder that he's a top-tier candidate now. When people really want to know, like, we're interested in his McKinsey years, we're really digging into his past.
20s.
So this is a sign that this is a serious candidate in the top tier. And then the friction between Warren and Buttigieg has grown, like, since he's been surging in Iowa. This is a critical state for both of these candidates. This is a fight they're having about transparency, and it's a fight that is a little. It's about Warren's work and how much she made, and this is a tougher position for Democrats and progressives, especially when you rail against big corporations and it looks like making any money, it makes you a hypocrite. And it's a problem for Democrats. And it's about whether you look like you're putting not money where your mouth is. But it's a sign that these two candidates are the ones to watch.
And of course, the president will be seeking to make his affirmative action as well as against his critics. He'll look at jobs, as we mentioned. He'll be able to point to the update of the NAFTA deal, the USMCA, and he'll seemingly at least have the outlines of the phase one of a deal with China. U.S. suspending plans for tariffs on $160 billion on Chinese imports are set to take effect this weekend. September 1st, tariffs cut significantly in half. Previous tariffs remain in place, and China making promised purchases of U.S. products, as well as some promised structural changes. We've been hearing from an incisive group. Last voice you heard was that of Annie Carney, a White House correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks, Annie, for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
We've also been hearing from Liz Landers, D.C. correspondent at Vice News. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you, David.
And our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Thanks, as always, Jack.
Thank you, David.
Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitters and Facebook. We're produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Down, Mylena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Lyons, Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiff, and me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.